Hello, welcome to episode 173 of the Chattering Classes. We're talking to Adam today. We're talking some evolutionary brain stuff. Yeah, that's how smart I am. And also, what did you do in the pandemic? What did you learn? Oh, let's see. We'll get Adam to join us and play the thing with the music. See, cool. Yep, your sounds good. My sounds good. Dislocating a shoulder—that's not a fun time. So, yeah, the old mountain biking accident's always a tricky one, isn't it?
I wouldn't like it.
No, I remember this is a weird tangent already. But I remember I used to do this when I went to teach at a writer's camp. The students would come and have like 3 days where they were just kids who were interested in writing short stories, and you would give them topics. And we did one on how to murder someone. Like, if you're doing crime fiction, you got to know how to actually murder someone and, get away with it. And then they have to create like the perfect murder, but they're terrible at it. They're just like, oh, just murder someone and hit them over the head with a hammer. And then I would run away. Like, it was just like, and then what? And then, oh, which person? They're like, oh, I don't know, just a random. You're like, okay, go to a random person's house. How do you know they've got security? Anyway, there was one kid, and he was like, I just go to like a mountain bike trail, and when someone came on, I just push him off. I was like, that's pretty good. You'd have to make sure of it, but that's pretty good.
I can remember when I was in year 5 or so. I grew up in America,
Yeah.
and we all had to write short stories as one of the modules we were doing at a time.
Yeah.
One of the things the teacher did was choose one story that would submit to some sort of national prize competition or something like that, and
Yeah.
all the students would vote on it. And everybody was writing stories about fairies or this or that, and I wrote a quite morbid horror story that was a bit too much for the teacher. I won the class prize, and
Yeah.
everybody wanted it to go into the competition, but the teacher refused in the
Yeah,
end.
that sounds about right. Yeah, okay. Yeah. That's the thing with creative writing sometimes is we're like, we want you to write and express all these creative urges, and then the students write really dark stuff, and teachers are like, ooh, should we be worried about them? Like, no, you encourage them to do this.
Yeah,
That's
and
what I.
I turned out all right.
Yeah, it's weird, right? We encourage you. No, we don't want that. It can't be too dark or effective or make the teacher freaked out. That's successful, but we don't want that. It's too scary. Too scary. Anyway, all right. Well, I am joined this week by Adam Bode. How are you, sir?
I'm very well, thanks, Matt.
Now, can we let the listeners in on how we met?
So we've met through mutual acquaintances at dance parties where 40, 50, and 60-year-old people are boogieing down to music from their youth. Recently, there's been a spate of events put on by a promotion company that was very popular in Canberra in the early 2000s and late 90s, and a lot of fun.
Yeah. And we kind of meet like roughly once a year.
Yeah,
So
once a
we see
year,
each other and we're
maybe
like, oh,
twice
it's
a
you.
year, we're
Maybe
partying
twice a year.
hard.
We're like, oh, cool, you're here, let's go. Let's have a dance. And let's have a few drinks. It starts at 1:30 in the afternoon,
I
which
was
is
in bed by 10 at the most
yeah.
recent one. It was
Yeah.
amazing.
We were home by 9 o'clock. We went back to our mutual friend's house, picked up our kids, brought them home. Yeah, home by 9 o'clock. What a great day.
Great day.
Yeah. So while we were there, I just overheard you talking to our friend Pete about a couple of things, and I thought, oh, I've got to get before we've had too much to drink, before we've had a dance, I'll have to ask Adam to come on the podcast because there was a couple of things that you mentioned, and I was like, I need more information. So the first thing I wanted to talk to you about was during the pandemic. So obviously we go into lockdown. You're living in Canberra then?
Yep.
You're living in Canberra during the pandemic, and you needed, what did you say? You couldn't do your hobbies. Now, what were your hobbies?
Sure. So in 2020 and 2019, I was playing squash quite regularly. I was swing dancing once a week and going to the swing dancing socials on the weekends and so forth. And that was taking up a fair bit of my time.
So, had you done any dancing before you started swing dancing?
I'm not a natural dancer. I was a gymnast when I was young, so I do have some control of my body and understanding of the body, but I'm not a natural dancer. And about, I don't know, 6 or 7 years ago, I was just walking home from work one day and I heard some jazz coming out of a community center. And I popped my head in and I said, "What's going on here?" And they go, "Oh, it's the first week of a swing dancing course. Would you like to do it?" And I thought, why not? So I've been doing that on and off. It goes in waves on and off for the last 5 or 6 years. I'm proficient but not good. I certainly don't look good. I've seen videos of myself dancing and it's a little bit embarrassing, but it's good wholesome fun.
So that's the same as the like the over 40s, 50s, 60s, 70s dance party things that we've been going to. I don't need anyone taking a video and needing to see what I look like when I dance. I'm having a good enough time
Yeah,
not to have to see it back.
there's an unwritten law about those sorts of things.
Yeah, absolutely. I was talking to people about it too the other day about there are some people there at these events who their age is fairly indeterminate, where you don't know if they're very old or if they've had a hard life or a hard like Saturday night lives, I guess, out on the town. They look fairly weathered, but you don't know whether it's by just age or I guess other effects.
Yeah, sure. Well, you and I have pulled up reasonably well. Certainly making a comparison with a few of the people, and I know exactly the sort of people you're talking about. But yeah, each to their own, and I guess we're just blessed.
Blessed. Hashtag. I wanted to go back. You said you were a gymnast when you were younger.
I was.
So what? Tell me about that.
Yeah, so I started doing like kinder gym when I was 5 or 6 years old, which is a great sport if parents are thinking of something that they want their kids to be involved with at a young age that's a bit social but physically interesting and novel for them. I definitely recommend that. And I was a gymnast just for fun up until about the age of 14. When I was in America, I went to school in America. I lived there from the age of 8 to sort of 14. And I was on the high school gymnastics team. And so it was a regular part of my life. And when I came back to Australia, I started taking it quite seriously. So we were training, 4 hours a day, 6 days a week, plus 2 mornings a week, sort of thing. So not quite the sort of level that Olympians would be training at, but it was more than just a hobby.
Right.
And I was never a very good gymnast, but I
All
could
right.
do it. If that makes sense. So,
Yeah.
to a person who wasn't a gymnast, they would see me and they would be very impressed. But I was
Yeah.
never going to make an Olympic team or a World Championships team or anything like that.
So did you have any like desires for that though? Like when you were doing it at a younger age and when you were training, was that in the back of your mind that that was a goal or was it more just participation?
So it was a passion at the time, absolutely. And I can remember when I retired, we call, from the sport when I was almost 18, a great sadness and grief that fell over me. I was never aiming for Olympic Games or World Championships, but I was aiming to perform well at national championships and get to some international competitions. And I did represent Australia once, twice actually, once against a New Zealand team. New Zealand's about as good at gymnastics as you'd expect. And another time we did a tour to China. And it was basically just a bunch of rich kids whose parents paid for them to compete in a
To
nationally
go to China
represented
and yeah, right. So were there any specific events that you enjoyed more than others in gymnastics?
Sure, definitely. So I was terrible on the rings and pommel horse. I'm short like a lot of gymnasts are, but I'm quite stocky and broad. So I benefited a lot in floor and vault, where power through the legs is a great benefit. I could do all around some pretty decent skills on those events. I did have a few top-level skills that I could do. They're not called tricks, they're called skills.
Right.
And so I could do this one thing on high bar where it's a dismount, where you let go of the bar and you do two backflips with your body straight and twist around twice at the same time and land on
Right.
your feet. And so I suspect at the time there were probably fewer than 1,000 people in the world that could do that.
Right.
So that made me feel good. But when you've got to put together entire routines, I just didn't have it.
Right. Well, I guess when you get to that level, like you said, for anyone watching or hearing you say that, we're like, whoa, that's super impressive. But once you get to that level, it gets quite, I guess, the minutiae of it, right? Like the small things of that what you can do amazingly well set you apart from the rest of the people who can do it really well.
Absolutely. And the thing that about gymnastics that people might find interesting is that it's still progressing at a really rapid rate.
Yeah.
So if you look at the sorts of skills people were doing in the 80s and 90s, when I was training in the 2000s, they were nothing. And I could, if when I was training in 2000, if I had competed at the 1970s Olympics, I would have won.
Right.
But the sorts of skills that people are doing now are just absolutely obscene that 20 years ago people had told you they would be doing. You just wouldn't believe them.
Right. So I want to go back to you doing your back. Your two backflips with twists and things like that. The thing I'm interested in, especially gymnastics, skateboarders, anyone who does those skills, not tricks, those skills, is like, how do you do that for the first time?
Sure. So all decent gymnasiums have what is referred to as a pit, which is basically a big hole in the ground full of foam blocks.
Yep.
So your coach will explain what's going on. You've seen other people do it, so you've got some sort of idea. You run your body through the general moves that you'll be doing, and you just give it a go. And
Yeah.
inevitably, it's not going to work out very well.
Yeah.
The other thing with gymnastic skills is sometimes you can build upon layers of difficulty. So
Right.
with that, you start off by doing a dismount, just doing two backflips in a tucked position. And then eventually you change that to being doing two backflips in a straight position.
Right.
And then you add a full turn. And then you add the second full turn.
Right.
And once you're doing it in the pit onto mats,
Yep.
so you're still pretty cushioned if you go something goes wrong. Eventually, one day you just try it on
Yeah.
a hard surface, and it's absolutely petrifying. It really is.
All right.
One of the reasons I was never that good at gymnastics is I was a bit of a scaredy cat. I did have trepidation about doing a lot of these things. Some people just have no fear.
Yeah, you gotta wonder if that's part of that elite sport, right?
I'm
Is like
sure it is.
they're just like, well, we've all trained, but I don't, like you said, if you're terrified while you're going through the air and they're not, then that's gonna probably serve them better. But wow. Right. I'm always fascinated by like the first time you actually try it, the first time you like in a competition you tried it, the first time you actually pull it off, what can go wrong? Like what are the things that have happened where it
Yeah.
goes wrong? Everyone likes to hear what happens when it goes wrong.
So there's some tragic stories about people injuring themselves in gymnastics, and even myself on two occasions I thought I might die, just because I was performing a skill and it went wrong. And I don't know if you've ever been in a car accident or had something really shocking happen, but time slows down. And
Yeah.
so I'm floating in midair, and it feels like for seconds. It would have been just a flash in the pan. But it
Yeah.
feels like seconds there, and your body and your mind make this decision. I don't have control over the situation.
Right.
Something bad could happen. And your body just reacts in a certain way. It sort of goes limp. So, one of the worst things you can do is go really firm and hard
Yeah.
because things are going to bend and break and that sort of stuff. This is why soccer players fall over all the time because, going at speed, if you get tripped, if you try to stay up, you're going to injure yourself.
Yeah.
So you just go with it. And on both those occasions, I ended up not even injuring myself. But I had a friend who a few years earlier had done a dismount off high bar, and he landed peculiarly and snapped his leg.
Oh, God.
There was another guy whom I didn't know at a national championships one year who actually broke his back, unfortunately.
Right.
And these are very rare. And
Yeah.
the coaches are trained and skilled to know how to spot and how to support people to do skills. And People have to trust their own instincts about these sorts of things, and they're pretty rare, but they do happen.
Yeah, God, that again, that must, when they happen, then again, the next time you have to do it
Oh,
after seeing
can
it,
you
you know,
imagine being
like,
the next guy to go?
yeah, exactly. Like, oh God, how to put that out of your mind. Again, getting to that like high level. You said before about the like retiring around 18 and like the you said the grief of that. So is that just because that had just been a major part of your life? Like you said, you were doing it at high school, you're doing it so many hours a week. Or is there something about like the competition ending, or what do you put that down to?
So there's probably a number of things. So at the very basic level, it was, 30 hours a week of something that I just stopped doing.
Yeah.
So that's a big rupture to the way you structure your life. I was passionate about it. It was something I really enjoyed. So there was that element of it.
Yeah.
Also, when you're 18, you're trying to define yourself. Being a gymnast was basically my identity. So all throughout high school, I'd turn up on a Monday and people would be talking about parties that they'd gone to and how much fun they had had. And I had Friday night been training, Saturday morning been training, and Sunday recovering. And so it really was something that defined who I was. And there was an element of grief, I think, for who I was before. And I had to come to terms with the fact that I hadn't achieved a goal as well. I wanted to be not a top level gymnast, but I wanted to be a competitive international gymnast, and I just never got there.
Yeah, I wonder about those, any kind of sport that you do as a program when you're younger, and on and on and on it goes. There has to be that kind of reckoning, right? That moment where you realize whether it's like you said, as you said, retire, or where you just realize that it's never going to happen for you. And you put your, like you said, you had that identity connected to it. Then I don't think people talk enough about that grief of like we do, it's all positivity and goal setting, but what happens to you when you realize you're not going to achieve your goal?
Absolutely. And I have read a paper many years ago talking about rates of depression in ex-elite athletes. It's apparently quite high. And that's probably for the reasons you've outlined there. But also, these people stop doing exercise, which is good for the mind and body as well.
That's right, yeah.
And the sort of levels they've been doing it at would be really good for the mind and body.
Yeah.
And a lot of them just go, sedentary, and they don't have focus in their life, and often they've forfeited educational attainment to pursue their sport, so they're at a disadvantage in the business market,
Yeah.
in the workplace, and so forth. And so there's a lot going against ex-athletes, I would assume.
Yeah. Now in like more elite sports, there are actually pathways out of the sport. Like they actually do training for pathways out of the sports now at those elite levels, because that's what they were finding. It's like a lot of these athletes retire. They might have, amazing careers, but they still retire and they're 35. And then, and what do they do now? And that's, they got adulation and glory for all that time, or everyone hated them, depending who they played for. And then that's gone, and they just go, all right, see you later. And a few people get back into broadcasting, but most of them, that's about it.
Yeah, most
So
people aren't cut out for broadcasting, that's for sure.
no. So they, again, like you said, they forego on their education and all of that stuff. So they have pathways in and pathways out, but that's limited to, like you said, those elite sports where there is a lot of money in them, I guess, where those programs can generate. So you mentioned that you lived in America. I don't think I knew that. When did
Yeah.
you? When did you, what did your, was that because your parents work, or?
Yeah, my father was a senior officer in the Air Force, and he had a couple of postings to a small town called Greenville, where there's some American defense industry doing something. I'm not meant to know what he was doing, but it had something
Right.
to do with planes because he was in the Air Force. Yeah, so he initially had a 3-year posting and then an extension and then a second posting. And we lived in a rich white town called Rockwall, which at the time was a town of about 15 or 20,000 people that was sort of a 45-minute drive from Dallas. If you
Right.
go there now, it's actually considered a suburb of Dallas just because there's been such expansion. But it the way Dad described it was basically like an American movie. The high school I went to had a tennis court, like Olympic grade tennis court. The gymnasium where I did gymnastics was better than the AIS gymnasium we have here in Australia.
Right, yeah.
It was a rich white town. There were a handful of black families in the town, and their kids played on both the basketball and gridiron team
Right.
because they were the only ones that were any good.
Yeah.
There were some Mexican families, and they mowed our lawns,
Right.
a few Puerto Ricans, and so that sort of thing. It was a surreal experience. It was really wonderful living there.
Yeah.
I didn't feel like I fit in. I always knew I wasn't an American,
Yeah.
despite speaking with a strong Texas drawl.
Right. Does
But
that come back? Does that come back to you every now and then?
so I've been accused of sounding like I have a bit of an accent.
Right.
What happened when I returned from America? I went to St. Edmund's, which, for those of you not from Canberra, is a Catholic school here that does high school years. And I copped it. I got ridiculed to no end for speaking with an American accent. So I did what I could to lose the accent as quickly as possible.
Yeah.
And to do that, I probably overcompensated a little bit and started sounding a little bit English
Yeah.
or just not right. And sometimes people think I might be a Kiwi or have lived overseas or that sort of thing.
Yeah, you sort of flatten, right? So you flatten your accent to.
So the Americans pronounce their R's.
Yeah.
So I lived on a street in America called Dartbrook, Dartbrook. And when my father would pronounce it to people, they'd have no idea what he was saying, but we'd say Dartbrook.
Yep, that's the one. Yeah, it's the accent, the Australian accent. When we taught in Japan, that was the thing we'd always say at the start of, like, what did you do today? And they would look at us like, what are you talking about? And we would say, I'll repeat myself, like, what did you do today? And they would say, are you saying to die? And I was like, what? We'd always be like, no, today. But it's so strange to their ears. It actually makes it sound like we're saying, what did you do to die? Because we're so Australian.
I know exactly what you mean. I mean, when we say, what do you mean? We don't
Yeah.
say, what do you mean? What do you mean?
Yeah.
I'm learning French at the moment, and French has liaisons, is what they call it,
Yeah.
more so than almost any other language. And the difference between the French you're taught in class and the French you hear on the street is so pronounced, it makes it really challenging to be able to understand what's going on.
Yeah. So you that's the other thing you said was that during the pandemic, we started off talking about this. That was about 20 minutes ago now. What I was trying to get to is you put aside you couldn't go dancing, you couldn't play squash, and you decided to learn French.
So, if you can throw your mind back to the beginning of COVID, it was a little bit scary.
A little bit, a little bit, a teeny bit.
It didn't turn out to be quite as bad as we thought it might be. But at the time,
Yeah.
we were petrified. Everybody
Yes.
took it very seriously, and we thought we were in the long haul, and we were in the long haul for these restrictions that were placed upon us. I couldn't play squash, which was a great shame. I couldn't swing dance anymore. I needed to do something ideally social that was going to keep me entertained. I actually lived in France when I was sort of 2 and 3 years old, and I studied French in high school, although I couldn't speak any French for the life of me, despite spending 4 years learning it in school. And
Yeah.
I thought, oh, maybe learning a language might be a good idea. I'll pick French because I already speak a small amount of it. And I just started on one of those online language learning websites where they connect native tutors with people who want to learn. And I just did 3 hours a week on a Monday, Tuesday, and Thursday for 1 hour a pop with a native French speaker. And we just started speaking French. I couldn't understand almost anything they were saying at the beginning. I could convey bits and pieces because, you know, I probably spoke at what the Europeans would call an A2 level.
Yeah.
And over the span of a year, I improved substantially the tutor, not only just through conversation practice, but also through teaching me a few grammatical points that were necessary to learn, really improved my language substantially. And then when we got out of the lockdown period, I started doing classes at the Alliance Française, which is a government-funded French language school, a French government-funded French language school here in Canberra and all around the world. And I've been sticking with it, and I can talk about most things now, one-on-one, and I can understand roughly what is going on when I listen to the radio.
So it sounds like you're quite good at, like, when you pick something, you is it focused, do you think, or is it you tend to, it sounds like you commit to it, like, I'm going to do this, I'm going to do it to a higher level. Doesn't have to be like, you know, that elite level, but you don't sound like you do things by halves. You sound like you do it, you enjoy it, but
that's true and not true at the same time. So there's a million things I've started that I didn't progress with, but the things that I do stick with, I tend to be above average with, I suspect. And that might be part of the reason I stick with them, because, oh, I'm kind of good at this, I am going to continue to pursue it, and so forth. So I've got ADD. I wasn't diagnosed until I was an adult. I don't take any medication for it. It was absolutely atrocious when I was young. Now it still causes me a few problems, especially I'm doing a PhD at the moment, and it makes some aspects of that a bit challenging. And my room's a mess. The living area is fine.
But, yeah.
I'm certainly not conscientious. We'll say it that way.
So if your room's a mess, do you look at your room and go, my room's a mess? Or do you look at your room and go, this is good?
No, it's definitely not good. Every now and then I get the motivation to put into it and get it clean, and it stays clean for a few months. And then when I say a mess, it's a relative thing. I mean, I still live here. I'm healthy, so it's not
squalor, too bad. Isn't it?
There's definitely clothes strewn about, and I don't think I've ever made a bed in my life.
That's pretty good. That is a good good boast. So I want to get to your PhD, because again, this is why I was like, oh, I might have him on the podcast, because you're learning French and you're studying French because you might go to France, or you're hoping to win a place. And I was like, sorry, what's your PhD? Do you want to explain to people what your PhD is? And then I'll have some questions.
Sure. So I'm doing a PhD in the School of Archaeology and Anthropology in a discipline called Biological Anthropology. Mm-hmm. Biological Anthropology is the study of human evolution and variation. I'm really on the edge of Biological Anthropology because I'm studying a psychological phenomenon that your listeners would understand to be romantic love.
Uh-huh.
So romantic love is basically a motivational state. It's essentially that thing that happens at the beginning of a romantic relationship where you go a little bit crazy and think your loved one's the best thing since sliced bread. And I'm studying it from an evolutionary perspective. Basically, no one has done this before. So I've got a lot of low-hanging fruit that I'm just sort of picking as I go through this 4 or 5 year process of getting a PhD.
So how far into the process are you?
So I'm technically part-time now. Right. So the equivalent, I'm sort of in the middle of my fourth year.
Right.
I'm due to submit in the middle of this year. That's may or may not happen. No big deal. But I'll probably submit sometime this year.
So, I mean, how did you come to that topic, to look at the evolutionary nature of the anthropological nature of romantic love?
Like so many people in academia, by luck.
Yeah.
So I had a bit of an early midlife crisis. Both my parents died within the span of about 4 years at one stage, and I just wanted to do something different with my life. And I've got a law degree, so I thought maybe I'll become a lawyer. So I started the postgraduate training to become a lawyer and absolutely hated it and dropped that after 3 months. I thought maybe I'll become a psychologist. And so I got a job working in the mental health sector to build up my resume, and I applied for some postgraduate positions and I actually got one, but decided against that because I realized through working in the mental health sector that I don't think I'd enjoy helping people in a one-on-one environment with mental health problems all day, every day.
Yeah.
And so I thought, well, look, I always assumed I'd do a PhD. So why don't I do a PhD? Let's just pick a topic that interests me. And when I was an undergrad student, I wrote an essay on the biology of romantic love for a neuroscience unit. And at the time, I found it absolutely fascinating because it's a mixture of psychology and neurobiology and endocrinology. And there's surprisingly so little written on the topic that you can get your head around basically everything that's ever been written. And so I picked that as a topic, and I contacted a few people here in Canberra at the university to see if they could supervise it. And the guy that agreed to supervise it was something called the human behavioral ecologist, which is someone who sort of studies the evolution of human behavior. And he said, look, you can, but we've got to take an evolutionary perspective on it. And that's worked out to be one of the best decisions of my life, just by pure luck.
So you said there's not much written about this. So, but in pop culture, in popular psychology, like in pop psychology rather than popular psychology, but in that pop psychology, so much is written about romantic love and what it means and where it comes from and how we feel.
Yeah, and
But not
most of
on
it's
a,
BS, mate.
yeah, I was going to say, but none of it is based on any kind of science.
I'm not saying none of it's based on any kind of science, but they really are taking a small amount of scientific knowledge and turning it into a 300-page book that's a number one bestseller on the New York
That's
Times.
right. Yes. And
Yeah.
then end with like how to find the perfect partner or how do you
Yeah.
know, call it how do you know you're in love?
Yeah.
That'd be a
So,
winner.
look, if we knew that, the world would be in a much better situation. And these online dating platforms would be much more effective. There's been approximately 40 biological studies of romantic love, which might sound like quite a few, but compared to, the mating habits of some salamander in the Amazonian forest in South America, it's not really that much. And we really are at a superficial stage of understanding. I mean, it's only been in the last few years that a good scientific definition of romantic love has come out. It's only now, through the work I'm doing with a number of collaborators, that we have any sort of understanding about sexual behavior and romantic love, or personality and romantic love, or even differences between women and men and romantic love. People just hadn't done this research up until recently.
But I read a scientific book called Men Are From Mars and whatever it is, Women From Venus, whatever that one is. So what you said we hadn't really got a scientific or we hadn't had a scientific definition of romantic love. Can you give us some kind of scientific definition?
Sure, I can give you the abridged version.
Yeah, for
So
sure.
it's a motivational state. That is to say, it guides our behavior and makes us act in certain ways. That's associated with a range of reproductive functions. So what it does is it chooses our long-term mates for us. When we're in love, we're convinced we want to be with that person. Sometimes it helps us pursue our mates. We can fall in love before we're in a relationship, and it makes us, display them, buy them flowers, roses, take them out to dinner, and try to trick them into thinking that they want to be our partner. It makes us have a lot of sex when we are in a relationship. In the early stages of a romantic relationship, when you're in love, you have a lot more sex than you do in the later stages of a romantic love. And it also does this thing called pair bond formation. So it binds us together to create those long-term relationships that can turn into lifelong bonds.
And so that can happen. So that's separate just from like any kind of deep friendship, or is that other connections?
It's conceptually different and biologically different and psychologically different. So both being in love and having a good friendship involve an attachment system. So it bonds us together, and it makes us interdependent and rely on each other and benefit from each other and create a fondness for each other and so forth. But romantic love is almost unique in that it's very intense, associated with a range of thoughts, feelings, and behaviors that are just absolutely extreme and serve really important reproductive functions.
So that's the main driver is the reproductive.
So that and survival. So in the modern environment, romantic love serves predominantly reproductive functions. In our evolutionary history, millions of years ago, when it probably existed, it also sort of facilitated survival of the species. So when a couple would fall in love, the man would protect the woman and provide food to the woman while she was pregnant and breastfeeding to ensure that the infant would survive. So all types of love play important roles in survival of the species, and romantic love is one of the unique ones. It also serves reproductive functions.
So, I mean, I know I want to read all of this. But what is when all you're studying and all your research, is there one moment you can think of that really sort of sticks in your mind or really freaked you out or really made you get super excited, especially at the start of your work?
So I, with my supervisor at the time, wrote the most comprehensive review of the biology of romantic love. And I mentioned that solid scientific definition of romantic love. That was actually a definition that my supervisor and I created. So
Right.
I'm one of the authors of that. And that was a great feeling because it was a genuine progression in science. I mean, science is made up of a number of small incremental steps, but also some large leaps. And
Yeah.
I think this definition was built upon a bunch of incremental steps, but represents a leap forward in our understanding of romantic love. And I was very proud of that when that came out. I read the paper now and I'm horribly embarrassed and thinking, oh, it could have been better. And I had it, I worded that way, or what was I thinking? But it's a genuine contribution to the science, and it's been reasonably well received among scientists.
Yeah.
Gets cited by other scientists on an almost weekly basis now, and so that was probably a very important step in my belief that I could do this quite well.
Right. So, I mean, the question I can't get my head around is why didn't this exist before? Like we have such popular discussion and like you said, that sort of generic ideas of love and even at the level that which you're talking at, I know you're simplifying a lot of it, but it all, stands to reason pretty solidly. We all kind of understand that in the back of our heads, what the goals of romantic love are, but why do you think the scientific approach hasn't like gazed on it?
Yeah, so I get asked this a lot, particularly in the media, because everyone's surprised when I say we're at the early stages of understanding this. So there's probably a few things that come into play, and I think the first one is funding. So science costs money,
Yeah.
and you need to basically scientists go out with a bowl saying, "Please give me money to do this cool thing that I think we should learn about." And the apparent benefits of studying romantic love, while they are there, probably aren't visible to a lot of funders and to a lot of people that make these sorts of decisions. So, believe it or not, the first scientific inquiry into romantic love was in 1978. And not long
Wow.
after that, a woman named Elaine Hatfield in America received a grant funding to pursue research in this area. But American politicians kicked up a fuss and demanded that the grant be rescinded, and they took her money away. So
Any
funding,
reason? Was any reason for that?
love's a magical thing, and we shouldn't be wasting scientific resources on this sort of rubbish, was basically the line they went with. So that's one thing. There is probably that notion of it being a magical, mystical thing,
Yeah, I was going to
but
say, like, a love is explored in art, right? Love is explored in song, in novels, in poetry,
it's ubiquitous.
throughout history. And so, do you think people like, oh no, don't be scientific about love? It'll take away, like you said, that mystery, that the magic of it.
There is that element of it. I mean, the other thing is, it's probably a little bit harder to study than some other things. Like, how do you measure love?
Right.
Scientists have come up with ways of measuring it, but they're not very good. Although recently there's been some good advances by a colleague of mine in Poland who has done an amazing paper validating a shortened scale to measure love. But it's not like, let's see how long it is and does it grow, or let's see how much it weighs.
Yeah.
It's conceptually complex and a bit hard to measure. So it's imprecise in that respect. So that's probably another element. I spoke to a science communicator recently who was writing a book and interviewed me because they wanted to get my perspective on love. And they said they'd spoken to a lab in America that did evolutionary biology. And they conveyed to her that they were interested in studying it, but they were worried they would be mocked by their colleagues. So it's the
Right.
man keeping the science down. I don't know what it is.
Yeah, wow. But I think, yeah, it either seems like you'll get pushback from people saying, no, we don't want to take the magic away, or that it's some kind of a frivolous endeavor, almost immature, right? Like, oh, like I need to know exactly how love works. I don't know.
I think that's right. It doesn't sound like serious science.
Yeah, except it is if they
But
haven't studied
it really
it.
is.
Yeah.
Having spent 4 years doing nothing but learning about how to study it and then study it,
Yeah.
it is a serious science. And I think it's actually also not only interesting but important. Romantic love's the basis for relationship and family formation throughout most of the world. There's a fertility crisis going on in the wealthy part of the earth. We're not going to learn how to promote fertility, promote family, healthy relationships, and so forth, unless we understand this phenomenon, which is the basic thing that sets it all off.
So what do you mean there's a fertility crisis?
Sure.
Do
So,
you mean that people aren't having children or they're not capable of having children?
not that they are not capable of having children, but they're
Right.
choosing to have fewer children. So in
Yeah.
countries like Australia and America and Canada and so forth, the rate of fertility is lower than 2.1, which is
Right.
what's required to maintain the population. And as a result, there's a large number of immigrants coming into the country, which I have no problem about, and we absolutely need. I'm pro-immigration. I think the economy would be in a lot of trouble if we weren't doing this.
Yeah.
But we're taking these people from somewhere else, and we're taking all their skilled labor, and we're leaving the countries they come from lacking doctors and nurses and engineers and so forth. And at a global level, it's not ideal. So
Yeah.
it really would be good if everybody could have 2.1 children or maybe a little bit more.
Yeah, right. Right. So are they connecting that shortage with you were saying, and this is where I think I'm lost for the first time, is how is that connected to this understanding of love?
Sure. So there would be very few couples in Australia with children who didn't start their relationship out by falling in love with each other.
Yeah.
It's basically a necessary precondition to people having children. And to that extent, the more we know about it, the better it's going to be understanding how to deal with this fertility crisis, it's sometimes referred to as.
Right. Wow. That's okay. Cool. So what is this you were mentioning that you were hoping to go to France and get a, I can't remember the term you use, a placement or get a position in France.
Sure. So I'll try not to reveal myself too
Yes, of
much,
course. Yeah.
but I'm because I've got to keep up appearances. But
Yep.
academia is very competitive,
Yeah.
and most people who do a PhD who want to work in academia won't be able to find a job in academia.
Yeah.
There tends to be two sort of options to careers following your PhD. And one's to do a traditional postdoctoral placement where you
Yeah.
basically go to another scientist's lab and you do research for them. And you do that for 1 or 2 or 3 or 4 or 5 years. And it's basically a sort of internship where you're learning about how to do research a bit better and
Yeah.
you're applying for your own grant funding so you can do your own research and create your own path in academia. The other path is something called a research fellowship, where somebody basically says, look, we think you're worth enough. We'll just give you some money and you can do whatever research you want. And so there's an Institute for Advanced Study in Toulouse, which is an interdisciplinary research center, which is right up my alley because I'm very interdisciplinary. And it's in France. I speak French. That would be cool.
Yeah.
It would be a great opportunity to go apply for some grant funding, do some more research so I can really establish myself as a leader in the field. And it's a 3-year position in France. That sounds all right.
Yeah, that does sound pretty good. I mean, it's Toulouse, I guess, not Paris, but that'll have to do.
Apparently Paris is not all it's made out to be.
No, I'm sure it isn't. I'm sure it isn't. Wow, that's oh well. Well, we are going to wrap it up tonight, but I have a feeling I might generate a few questions from myself, but also from listeners who might have further questions for you about all of this evolutionary science in terms of, romantic love. Would you come back on and answer their questions if we can gather some?
It's a date.
Lovely. All right. Well, thanks, Adam. And yeah, that's it.
Thanks, Matt.
Easy. Well, that's it for our first discussion with Adam. If you've got any questions, I know I've got more questions, send them through. You can email at chatteringpod@gmail.com, or you can send them through on Chattering Classes Pod on Instagram. And yeah, send them through and we'll reconvene with Adam. Any questions? Did it leave you angry? Did it leave you curious? Let me know. Give me feedback. We'll talk to him again and get some more answers. Meow.